First ladies of the United States have been hostesses, diplomats, reformers, role models, and even revolutionaries. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we'll visit the Hoover Presidential Museum to get a preview of the new exhibit, America's First Ladies. It's not all glitz and glamour.
Barbara Bush is interesting because she used to say that she didn't think she was a very pretty woman and she refused to dye her hair and she just didn't care. Just a great example of just believing in yourself, I guess, and being happy with who you are. And she really stressed that a lot.
I'll also talk with Catherine House about her new book, The White House, for kids. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Iowa was home to only one president, but we produced two first ladies. Iowan first ladies Mamie Eisenhower and Lou Henry Hoover share the spotlight with the rest of America's first ladies in a new exhibit at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Museum in West Branch. The exhibit opens on Saturday and will be on display through October, and we are here at the museum today to get a sneak peek. With me right now is historian Elizabeth Dinchel. She is education specialist at the museum. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hello, how are you?
Good. Thank you so much for having us here today. And I want to talk about the term first lady first. Where did that come from?
Well, when the president and the first lady took office originally, starting with Martha and George Washington, there was a lot of debate about what to call them. They were saying His Excellency or His Supreme Ruler of the United States. They didn't know what to call them. They didn't want to call them King and Queen. Martha started off as Lady Washington, actually. And the first time we see the words First Lady used are for Harriet Lane, and she was First Lady for James Buchanan, and that was March 31st, 1860, and it was used in print. Moving forward, they were still called Lady, being the Lady of the House, I'm assuming less formal than the Europeans would use it. But then they used it in a speech to describe Lucy Hayes, and from that point forward, they started saying First Lady.
So it's a term that really evolved over time.
Right. And Frances Cleveland was really the first woman who kind of owned that title and started referring to herself as First Lady.
From the very beginning, was a role for the First Lady somewhat clear?
Not at all. First Ladies don't have constitutional obligations. They're unpaid. Our first grouping of First Ladies were really concerned that they'd be interpreted as queens. So they worked with the servants, they prepared meals, they received people. Kind of moving into the 1800s, the shift for the presidency was the common man. And the common man tended to be a bachelor. So we would see a series of First Ladies that were cousins, sisters, wives, friends' wives. Dolly Madison was a hostess for two presidents. Jefferson was the other one. Jefferson's wife had passed away, so she was one First Lady, and then his daughter and Dolly Madison. So sometimes we'd see several First Ladies during one presidential term. After we kind of move away from this role of hostess, we started seeing the First Ladies take the roles that we see now, this idea of social reformer. Really, one of our turning points was Eleanor Roosevelt, who kind of took on that role. So we start seeing we see newer first ladies like Hillary Clinton, the first lady to run for an elected office. It was a big deal. One of the best pieces, I think, that are in the exhibit, I say that personally, we have Edith Galt Wilson's suit, her Worth suit, that she wore to the signing of the Treaty of Versailles. And it's important because Woodrow Wilson suffered a stroke during his term as president. And leading up to this point was that hostess role. And Edith Galt Wilson steps in, and she starts monitoring what he's signing, who he's meeting with, how people are interpreting him, and they start calling her the first woman president. And so here she is really making these huge decisions for a long span of time, several years, before he wasn't the president anymore. She really kind of gave power to the role of First Lady and set them up to be these powerful social reformers. We see Harrison being the first woman to hire staff to work in the First Lady's office. And we see the official term, Rosalind Carter, came in and said, This is the office of the First Lady. And now our First Lady houses more than 20 full-time staff members, several interns. It's a big office, and she's still unpaid.
You mentioned some of the women who served as hostess in the White House. You referred to them as First Ladies, even though they weren't married to the president. I have a hard time imagining if we had a bachelor president today, I would guess there wouldn't be a First Lady.
Probably not. And I think that maybe has more to do with social mores now, that we wouldn't assume that a woman would have to come in and play hostess for diplomats. I think they'd probably hire staff to deal with that. And that, again, goes to the idea that there's no constitutional duties for the First Lady. So we don't have to have a First Lady to serve people anymore.
You mentioned Edith Wilson, who played a remarkable role in world history in really stepping in when her husband was after his stroke. But let's go back a little bit to these remarkable hostesses. I mean, you mentioned Dolly Madison, who, of course, still is synonymous with the idea of a wonderful host and great snack cakes.
Right. And we actually talk about her bringing this kind of new elegance and class to the White House. Leading up to that time, our First Ladies were kind of disinterested in the White House. Abigail Adams was the first woman to live there, and she called it the Chilly Castle. She really disliked it, but Dolly Madison came in and remodeled and wanted fine French things in the White House. And so, you know, she was famous for being kind and not argumentative, because people like Abigail Adams, one of our first ladies, was very politically proactive and outspoken and would argue with guests, and people didn't like her. They were very critical of her for that. So Dolly Madison was a departure from that. She was a wonderful hostess.
So when did that shift start taking place from being thought of as the hostess of the White House, the entertainer for foreign diplomats, to really having a role in society in the United States?
We identify the roles in the museum. We have some interpretive panels that kind of outline those time periods. And we really identify Florence Harding as the first person into this changing perception and expectation from society. Because we would often say the role is really shaped by the person who fills it, you know, societal expectations. And Florence Harding came in, and it was this new time when there were social problems, and the media is growing, so there's this new spotlight on the First Lady. What is she doing? What is she wearing? Why is she wearing nice stuff when I'm not? You know, why is she driving a car when I'm not? So Florence Harding comes in, and she has to start working on kind of making things better and addressing people and kind of seeing the people as her own constituency. And then we see that evolve and become more powerful over time, really from that point on.
And many First Ladies have chosen a specific social cause that they would dedicate their time to after that.
Yes. For Nancy Reagan, we saw Just Say No to Drugs. For Lady Bird Johnson, she went through a huge beautification process in D.C. And she actually, she's not given enough credit for how she handled that situation, but she was not just concerned about the aesthetics of D.C., which a lot of her people were concerned about. There was a whole second part of that where they were really addressing inner city D.C., public spaces, playgrounds, and making that part of the beautification process and making sure that neighborhoods were safe and clean. And she decided to treat both of them equally instead of just focusing on one or the other. We see Michelle Obama's big program is Let's Move, and her hope is to eradicate child obesity in one generation. Hillary Clinton was appointed the head of a task force on health care reform, and that was really important for her. We see lots of First Ladies like that. Jacqueline Kennedy, actually going back even further, appointed the first professional curatorial staff into the White House and established a library. Lou Henry Hoover, and we love to talk about Lou because she's from our museum, she was the president of the Girl Scouts and made them economically viable at a time that they weren't sure they could financially support themselves. And part of the reason they're still around today is because of Lou. She started Girl Scout cookie sales. It's one of the biggest ways they support themselves. So all of the First Ladies kind of did. They had their pet projects. Eleanor Roosevelt had many. You know, she was the first lady of the world is what they called her. And they really needed a first lady like her during the times that she came in. And she filled those societal expectations. So she's remarkable, too.
Well, let's walk around the exhibit a little bit. I realize you're still under construction in some minor ways, although most things are put together. And I'm talking with Elizabeth Dinchel, who is a historian and also education specialist at the museum. Joining us also now is Melanie Weyer, who curated this exhibit. Hello, Melanie.
Hello.
So here we are at the beginning of the exhibit, and this first part is dedicated to the first ladies. The very first artifact we see is from Martha Washington, and we have the official photo or a replica of the official photo of her, a replica of one of her gowns, and then an actual artifact. And this is a mourning ring?
Yep. And so in the center of the ring, instead of a gemstone, there's actually hair. And so this was given to her by a relative that was ill, and so that way she could remember them after they had passed.
Wow. So the first dresses here are replicas, and who is this?
This is actually Abigail Adams, and one of the things that's great about this piece and just coming to see Abigail Adams is we have a bullet mold from the Adams Historic Site. And Abigail Adams was really this fierce woman who we would call a feminist now, but she was said to have melted the family pewter to make bullets for the American Revolution. She was a very boisterous first lady who pushed for women's rights and wanted them to write the right to vote. And she very famously wrote to her husband to remember the ladies and remember that all men could be tyrants if they could. And she wanted to petition Congress with girlfriends for rights for women. So having the bullet mold here is really a treat to kind of see this idea of what a revolutionary or founding mother was like. She held down the family farm when nobody else could do it. So it's really
and very famously wrote her husband a lot of letters with a great deal of advice for him in those letters.
Yes, and like we mentioned earlier, was very disliked and people were critical of her because of her political stances.
Why do you think it's valuable for people to see reproductions of the clothing that these women might have worn or did wear?
You know, First Ladies is kind of an interesting topic historically and for education because we can learn a lot about American material culture from our First Ladies. Because they were filling what society expected of them, they wouldn't dress extravagantly while people were poor, or they wouldn't dress very poorly while the country was thriving. So it's good for us to be able to see the First Lady's reproduction dresses and kind of get a sense of what America was like while they were First Lady.
We're walking through a new exhibit at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. It opens up on Saturday and showcases artifacts from America's First Ladies. With me right now is historian Elizabeth Dinchel, who's education specialist at the museum, and the curator of this exhibit, Melanie Weyer. We're walking through a new exhibit at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. It opens up on Saturday and showcases artifacts from America's First Ladies. With me right now is historian Elizabeth Dinchel, who's education specialist at the museum and the curator of this exhibit, Melanie Weyer. And let's talk a little bit about Lou Henry Hoover. And as you mentioned, I mean, she really created a powerful role for herself in the White House.
Yeah, and she's another one of our first ladies that I think we can comfortably argue was a feminist, which was a big deal in her time. But she very much pushed leadership being taught to girls. She thought women should work outside of the home.
And, of course, she was a college graduate. She was educated herself.
She was the first woman to get a degree in geology from Stanford University. She put Girl Scout leadership training in the colleges around the country. She was a remarkable woman and very intelligent. She was fluent in several languages. She was well-traveled. She traveled the world several times. We know that she was one of the translators of De Re Metallica, which is still the authoritative text for geology, even to this day. So she made very large contributions to the field of geology, her humanitarian work. She wrote the women's parts of the CRB bulletins and reports. She designed the mansion in Palo Alto, and that's now the President's House of Stanford. We actually have a painting of Minerva that came from the Palo Alto mansion. One of the other objects we have that you see here is one of the pieces of the Monroe desk. She liked the one in the White House so much that she had two copies made. One copy still at the White House. We recently received the other copy. And there's hidden drawers in the Monroe desk. And the story is that when she passed away, they found hidden in her desk checks and letters from people who tried to pay back her generosity, and she never cashed the checks or accepted the money. She was very, very humble and raised a Quaker, and that very much comes through in her personality. To our right, you can see that we have Lou Henry Hoover's alleged the 1929 Cadillac Cabriolet, and there weren't serial numbers on cars back then, but there were only a few made, and the provenance would lead us to believe that this is most likely Lou's car.
And she, was she the first lady, first lady to drive herself around?
And around the corner, there's an article up about it. It was kind of controversial for her to drive herself around, and she actually took a cross-country road trip, not in this car, in one of her other Cadillacs, and it was also considered to be controversial at the time. We have one of the lap robes that Cadillac would give to presidents, and it has the presidential seal on it. We don't know if this one belonged to the Hoovers or not, but this is from the right time period. There's another example of one at the FDR Presidential Museum as well. And this is a copy of Lou's official painting. Her official painting is hanging in the east side of the White House. There's two copies of it. This is one, and the other one is hanging in our Waldorf Astoria exhibit in our permanent galleries.
Now, she was quite famously as a child, a tomboy, and as you mentioned, a feminist, obviously a very strong woman. She was also a very beautiful woman, and this is a very feminine, lovely dress.
Yes, and Melanie can talk about it. She picked it out.
And a lot of we don't have a lot of dresses of hers, but we have a few, and all of them are very feminine, you know, soft colors, ruffles, layers. And so we picked this one because of the cape that goes with it. It's got rhinestones that look like diamonds that go around the collar of the cape. And so we use that as inspiration for the exhibit. So if you look around, there's touches of pink all throughout the exhibit and silver glittery material that makes you think of diamonds. And so the background on all the labels and text panels is actually a photograph of her cape.
And before we move on from Lou Henry Hoover, you know, we've talked a lot about how the first role of the First Lady was as the hostess of the White House. And of course, it still is one of the roles of First Lady. And she used that role to wield some really interesting and significant power. And one of the things she did with that role was invite the wife of an African-American congressman to tea, the first black woman invited to tea at the White House.
Yes, and in fact, we call it the DePriest Tea Incident here. And it's actually one of our favorite activities with students to look at it because it's this kind of post-Reconstruction time, but it's pre-1964 Civil Rights Act. And so there's a lot of racial tensions, especially in the South. And Lou very cleverly invited the congresspeople in waves, and she waited for the very last wave to have DePriest over because other wives of congressmen had said that they would not come if DePriest was invited. So she waited until the end, and she kind of made the press aware that it was going on without stepping up and saying why she was doing it. Lou, in her writings about leadership, led by example. And I kind of feel like this was her way of kind of telling the country, like, it's time that we start treating African Americans with more respect. She treated her staff, all of her African American staff, to redoing their rooms, making sure they had enough to eat, making sure they were taken care of when they were sick. And that was never a concern before. But she got hate mail from especially the South. She got a lot of supportive letters as well, but people were calling to impeach Lou Henry Hoover.
Is that possible?
It's not possible. You can't impeach the First Lady. There's no precedent for it. So it was a very interesting time for Lou to kind of step up, and she really stirred up race relations. And I think we know a little bit more about race relations because of this incident during that time period.
Well, let's go next to Mamie Eisenhower, the other first lady who was born in Iowa, Boone, Iowa, of course. Mm-hmm. And what do we have from Mamie Eisenhower?
Well, we have another pink dress that goes right along with Lou's.
It's very beautiful.
It is. And this is kind of a signature dress for her, kind of ball gown that she wore when she met the Queen. And so she liked to wear pink. It's kind of a signature style, signature color. And what's interesting is that in the photo that we have to go with the dress, it shows the Queen wearing a very, very similar dress. We don't know exactly if the color is the same because it's a black and white photo, but the style, the cut, it's got flowers on it as well, though they're not roses.
The bodice is almost the same.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's very interesting.
I wonder if that was any kind of a fashion faux pas to show up so closely gowned as the Queen.
Maybe they planned it. I don't know.
Made a little phone call before they got together. Somehow I doubt it. But yeah, in the official portrait of Mamie Eisenhower, she's also wearing a lovely, pink, but lovely, very, very feminine gown with long gloves and a little handbag.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And we have a handbag and gloves to match this dress as well.
And now, of course, as I mentioned, we know that Mamie Eisenhower was born in Iowa. What distinguished her as a first lady?
Mamie was also kind of in that same class as Lady Bird Johnson, where she was working on, you know, we kind of call it like a Leave It to Beaver type first lady, where she was really focused on family and children, and her social things were, you know, cleaning up the city around and or the neighboring cities and working with child literacy and families.
All right, let's continue on. We get to much more recent first ladies. You have a suit from Jackie Kennedy here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we think about her remarkable fashions. This is a somewhat understated suit.
Yes. It's a very simple suit. It's kind of like a mustard color.
When you requested dresses, mm-hmm. was there something you were hoping that they would be associated with? What kind of events were you hoping they'd be worn at?
Well, I think initially we wanted items from, like, state dinners, you know, the fancier dresses. I think everyone was hoping that we would get a pillbox hat for Jackie, but that didn't happen. So, I mean, the suit is, you know, it's very classic.
Yes, I can imagine her in it right now.
You know, for some of these, it's kind of what they decided to send. And so, but, you know, just the same, it's clothing that these ladies wore, and so it does tell part of their story.
Right. We have a Betty Ford dress right behind us, and very much, actually very similar to the dress that she wore for her official portrait.
Yeah, this dress kind of glows. It's a teal blue with a little hints of green, and it's got
very flowy.
Yeah, very flowy, long sleeves.
Now, I was surprised to see Nancy Reagan over here. I always think of Nancy Reagan in a red dress. This is a very understated suit. But she wore this doing some of the work that you mentioned earlier, Elizabeth, with her Say No to Drugs campaign.
Right. And we have some of the artifacts that go with that as well, the Just Say No to Drugs pin and the basketball that one of the teams signed at one of her events. And the dress is very not typical for Nancy Reagan.
So we have Rosalind Carter, of course, right before Nancy Reagan, and now we're up to Barbara Bush, again one of her iconic suits with the pearl necklace.
Mm-hmm. And Barbara Bush is interesting because she used to say that she didn't think she was a very, very pretty woman, and she refused to dye her hair, and she just didn't care. So she's a great, you know, just a great example of just believing in yourself, I guess, and being happy with who you are. And she really stressed that a lot. She was just who she was, and that was it. But she worked for literacy, and that was her big project, was trying to help kids learn how to read.
Here you have a suit from Hillary Clinton, and you have photos of her wearing this suit. She actually wore this to the inauguration of Nelson Mandela?
That's correct. So that's a suit with a matching hat that we have from her.
When Laura Bush is right next door, when did she wear this? It's a velvet suit, a maroon velvet suit.
This was picked out by her. And
I actually think, if I remember correctly, this was worn to one of Laura Bush's heart events. Yeah. And they actually did a series of exhibits of all red dresses for a healthier heart America. And she was really big and instrumental, actually, in bringing awareness to women's heart problems.
We're still waiting for Michelle Obama's dress, although you know what it's going to be, right?
Yes. So that will be like a powder blue suit, skirt suit.
Oh, and I see the photo of her in it, which is an iconic photo from not very long ago. That you can see Rosalynn Carter and Barbara Bush and Hillary Clinton and Laura Bush and also Michelle Obama all in a photo together. So she wore that suit when she was with all the other first ladies who
right.
are living.
Yes.
Wow. So now that we're standing right in front of Michelle Obama, we've talked about the evolution of the role of first lady. How do you think it has changed in just the past 6 years? Do you think that there have been changes made to this role that will continue?
Well, yeah, I mean, we're looking at a time now where most of these women are meeting their husbands in the profession, in the working place. So like Michelle Obama was an attorney, Hillary Clinton was an attorney, and so their career paths have almost mirrored their husbands. So it's interesting to see someone like Hillary Clinton come out and run for Senate and run for president. I think we're looking at the kind of theory of birds of a feather flock together. So we see these powerful, educated women alongside their husbands, and maybe they'll have, you know, continued career aspirations and political aspirations of their own, unlike Abigail Adams, who didn't have the option to vote yet and wanted to petition Congress but couldn't.
And certainly seemed like she would have run for Senate if she could have.
Probably, right. So you see people like Abigail Adams who would have loved to have run and couldn't, and now Hillary Clinton, who was around it and said, you know what, I'm going to get involved in this too. So now they're not just, you know, maybe we're moving away from the time where it's now just pet projects for first ladies into women kind of making the strive for their own power. And maybe we'll see our first female president in the near future, in our lifetimes, hopefully.
And then you'll put a suit up to represent her husband?
You never know.
Yeah, you know, we'll change it to first spouses.
Yeah. Well, thank you both for having us in today.
Yeah, thank you for coming.
America's First Ladies at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch opens to the public on Saturday. It will be open through October 26th. I spoke with historian Elizabeth Dinchel, education specialist at the museum, and Melanie Wire, curator of the exhibit. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Kids who visit America's First Ladies will probably leave talking about Mrs. Hoover's car, but there are a lot of fun and fascinating stories that kids will love about the presidents and their families and the house that they live in. My next guest, Catherine House of Iowa City, has written The White House for Kids, a history of a home, office, and national symbol. Catherine, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, thanks for inviting me, Charity.
Now, you grew up in Washington, D.C., right?
I was born in Washington, D.C., and I grew up in Arlington, Virginia. But that was less than 15 minutes from the White House. So we did go downtown and go to the museums and see the Capitol, and we would see the National Christmas Tree at Christmas time.
So what did you think about the White House when you were a kid?
What did I think about the White House? I don't know. I think it was just part of the landscape. I mean, we knew it was special. We knew it was on the news. Growing up in that area, you have an interesting perspective because what's on the national news is also the local news, because so many people worked for the government and still do. But all my friends, when I was growing up, their parents worked for the federal government. And so it was part of the landscape. But I will say that when we would drive downtown, and I asked the assistant curator if they still did this, but they fly a flag over the White House when there's a visiting dignitary from another country. And my mother was very teacher-like and was always asking us questions and quizzing us on history. And so we would drive by the White House to go somewhere, and she would say, oh, well, can you tell me who must be visiting the White House today by the flag that was flying there? So, you know, we did have those conversations, and we did go, not every year, but several times we did go see the National Christmas Tree outside and the smaller ones for the states.
All right, the Christmas tree lighting. Did you go for the actual
event?
We
never went for the actual lighting. I think, you know,
too much
parents,
standing outside in a crowd.
Well, and yeah, big crowds. And so, but yeah, so we did see the, you know, we did drive by it on regular occasions, and lots of other things in the area that had presidential ties. that they were constantly pointing out to us.
So when you decided that you would write a book about the White House for kids, did you have one thing in mind that you thought, I know kids are going to love this?
I don't think I had one thing in mind. After I moved away, I had done a lot of reading about the White House. And, you know, of course, when I was growing up, we would hear about the kids who live there and read about them in the newspaper and even watch inaugural parades on TV because, of course, there it was a federal holiday and the schools followed the federal holidays. And so we were off school for Inauguration Day, which I've told some kids here and they think that's a pretty good deal. So but I read a lot of books after I left the area by people who had known the presidents and had these sort of behind the scenes stories to tell. So former chefs and maids and first kids. And so those were the types of things that I wanted to put in my book, were the stories of the presidents being people and what was family life like and what was it like to go to school and that sort of thing.
Well, we'll get to some of those stories in just a moment. We're going to take a short break. I'm talking with Catherine House. She is the author of The White House for Kids, a history of a home, office, and national symbol. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we've been talking about the first ladies, and now we're talking about the whole first family and the house they live in. My guest is Catherine House of Iowa City. She has written The White House for Kids, a history of a home, office, and national symbol. And Catherine, before the break, you were talking about being excited about sharing behind-the-scenes stories about families in the White House. But I know the publishers wanted you to start with the building itself, and that was really the part that you found least interesting.
That's exactly right, Charity. When I wrote the outline and the proposal for the book for my publisher, I had the first chapter being growing up in the White House because I thought that would help suck in the readers and talk to them about going to school and their bedroom and maybe sharing a room and whether they could go swimming whenever they wanted to. And I had done a previous book where we had started that way. And when they came back to me and said, oh, well, you know, we want to publish your book and this looks really good, they said, but there's something we need to talk to you about. And I said, okay, what? And they said, well, we really feel like you need to start with the chapter that I had called or labeled The Biography of a Building, which is how we did start it, because when the editor tells you that you need to do something, you do it. And even though, I mean, I did. We had some back and forth. I said, maybe. But anyway, they persuaded me, and I'm happy that they did. But anyway, that was a hard thing because I did think that the biography of the building, I mean, the name, the dates, and how many rooms it has, and some of those drier facts, and maybe what Washington D.C. looked like when they first built the White House. I just couldn't see starting this book with a scene of the very sparsely settled, you know, capital.
But, and you didn't.
And
you
I didn't.
You
so I didn't. I just did it the way I wanted to do it.
You pulled out some really interesting stories about this building, the White House, though. You know, I think a lot of us know a little, if we're political history junkies at all, you know, we know a little bit about when the White House was built and the War of 1812, when the British were coming and burning down Washington, D.C., and that image of Dolly Madison cutting the George Washington portrait out of the frame to save it from the flames. And the White House was really seriously damaged
yes,
in that fire.
Was.
But those early presidents lived in this house that was barely finished and not a very nice house to live in. And I'm sure that kids do find that to be somewhat interesting when they think of this big palatial mansion that the presidents live in, the fact that for a
right.
while it was drafty and felt a little like an empty barn.
Right. Well, and there's the classic story that I think at least a lot of adults know about Abigail Adams hanging her laundry to dry in the East Room because it was this unfinished room and it was this open place where she could hang her laundry. And they actually, the Adamses, only lived there for a few months, but they had to go outside to use the bathroom, which I mean, for kids today, just would probably seem appalling, like you said, that this big glamorous house, that was what was required. Right. But, you know, that wasn't uncommon at the time anyway, you know, but it just seems out of character with our modern day vision of what the White House is and what it represents.
You also write about an extensive renovation that was done in the 1950s under President Truman.
Yes.
And tell us a little bit about the condition of the house leading up to that renovation, because I was surprised by how bad things had gotten.
Yes, the house in the 1940s, he said it almost seemed like it was falling down. There was just his family actually moved out during the renovation. It was that extensive and complete. And I really even hesitate to use the word renovation because it was basically a reconstruction on the
gutting
inside of the White
rebuilding.
House. It was gutted. Gutted is a great word for it. We have a picture in this book, which is one of my favorite White House pictures, showing the bulldozer in the basement or the ground floor of the White House and the steel girders. And so they took out the walls and the floors and everything and rebuilt it. Now, they rebuilt it the very similar floor plan, and they think they did save some wood trim and some different pieces, and they tried to recreate, you know, and maintain the historical integrity of the house. But they did really have to take it apart. And I think a piano had gone through partially from one floor, and it had fallen. The piano leg had fallen. I don't know how far down it went into the ceiling in the next room. And there were just a couple of other things like that where, you know, I think floors vibrated when people walked, you know, across the floor above it or the ceiling did. Chandelier swayed, I think, is the one story. And part of that was because of the construction shortcuts that had been taken previously, first after the War of 1812, when they did have to rebuild parts of the White House. But probably also at least as significantly was when they added a complete third floor to the White House in the early 1900s. And I guess it was too heavy, the construction method and everything. And so that really compromised the structure. So it was all these things leading up to, you know, it's a home that's been there a long time and been through a lot of changes.
Well, we do think about it as this big palatial mansion. And, you know, there have been wings added to the White House and a
sure.
lot of different changes made over the years. And when I was talking with the people at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum, we were talking about the fact that, you know, presidents brought a lot of people with them into the White House in the early years. They would bring a lot of extended family.
Yes.
And also, presidents tended to have bigger families. So the White House was really packed to the gills during a lot of administrations.
It was, particularly, I think, during the, the 1800s, but the classic example is in the early 1900s when the Theodore Roosevelt family moved in with his six children. But you have to remember that was before the West Wing or the East Wing were built. And so the offices for much of that time during the 1800s were the president's offices were upstairs. And I think in the movie Lincoln, I can't remember if that was pictured, but there was a whole sort of area at the end of the second floor where the family lived that was the office area for the president and his staff. And yes, they did bring extended families. They brought their own servants. Servants used to live in the White House. And for some of the early presidents, they brought slaves. And there was a story, which I'm pretty sure was from a reliable source, talking about one of the presidents. And I think it was pre-Civil War. And people were just starting to get really sort of upset about the whole idea of slavery. And they moved his slaves. I think they were in the basement or the ground floor and people could actually see them. And what I had read, they moved them up to the third floor so they wouldn't be as visible and in your face to people. Because, of course, at that time, the White House grounds were a public park and,
right.
you know, it was much more accessible than it is today.
Well, and let's talk about Teddy Roosevelt and his family, because he did have a big brood and a
yes.
rambunctious brood.
Is a great word.
And you tell a wonderful story about Quentin Roosevelt and his friends getting into trouble. So tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, that's one of my favorite stories in the entire book. And it's actually how I started the chapter about growing up in the White House. And some people have heard bits and pieces of this story. Usually it's recounted in a couple of sentences to say Quentin Roosevelt and his friends got in trouble for throwing spitballs at a portrait in the White House. But I went back to the original source, which was written by one of his co-conspirators. conspirators, if you will, one of his friends who had been there, and they were supposed to be there for sleepover. They were, in fact, there for sleepover. And they did throw spitballs at a portrait of Andrew Jackson and then left it alone. They went raced off to do other things.
With the spitballs still sticking all over the portrait.
And, you know, you do that, somebody's going to notice. And so the president noticed, and the story that Earl Looker, who wrote the book, I think it was called The White House Gang, but he recounts, is that they were asleep. And President Roosevelt came into the room very upset and pulled Quentin out of the room and told him he had to help clean up. But then even funnier than that, I mean, that's what you would expect. But then the next day, President Roosevelt just had sort of this mini trial, this inquisition, and asked all of the boys how this had happened and who had did it. And the problem was they really didn't have their stories straight. So a couple of them, you know, as kids do, tried to take the blame or said, well, I think I did. And that just, you know, that just made the president even angrier because he didn't like the dishonesty. And he said when he got a phone call in the middle of this whole exchange, and when the White House usher came to talk to him, he said that he was busy dispensing justice. And he called it a trial, and he labeled them gangsters and told them that this wasn't their house and that it was the government, you know, belonged to the government, and that they really had just a very small part.
The funny thing as you go on is to find out that Quentin was not the child that Teddy Roosevelt had the most trouble with. And you have this wonderful quote that you shared from Teddy Roosevelt about his oldest daughter, Alice.
Yes.
And Alice. Let me see. He said, I can either run the country or I can attend to Alice. I cannot possibly do both.
Yes. Yes. Alice was his daughter from the first marriage. And his wife had died, I think, the day she was born or about that time. And so she was older than the other kids, and she had a stepmother, and she was just very lively for that time. There's a story that's recounted that probably people have heard before where I think he said, you cannot smoke under my roof, because she liked to smoke. So she solved the problem, and she went up on top of the White House and smoked on the roof. So she was that kind of
and,
child.
And she was also known for walking around the White House with her
pet snake.
Snake,
yes, Emily Spinach,
her
pet snake. So, but I like to bring those stories up because I think, you know, kids can relate to them. But also when I start the whole chapter with that story about Quentin, I say, you know, if that were any other child, I mean, we've all done things we weren't supposed to. We've all gotten in trouble from our parents. He was grounded. But, you know, if he hadn't been the son of a president, we still wouldn't be talking about him 100 years later.
Yeah.
And I really think it's important to tell the readers and show that perspective, because when I talk to children, especially younger children, about the White House, they just get starry-eyed and just think, oh, there's a swimming pool and there's a bowling alley and there's all this fun stuff and I'd be rich. And really, knowing what I know now, I don't know that I would want to grow up in the White House under that
publicity.
Well, you're
right, quite poignantly about Amy Carter trying
yes.
to walk to public school and everybody looking at her and then lining up all of the, well, I guess I won't call them a paparazzi. They were called the White House Press or the, you know, the Washington Press would line up
right.
at the fence of the playground to take pictures of her on the
yes.
playground, which, of
yes.
course, is one of the reasons that so many presidents send their children to private
yes.
schools. The Kennedys actually homeschooled.
Yes.
So that
yes.
they wouldn't have to subject
well,
their
they didn't
kids
do
to
it.
Them.
They started
right.
a school upstairs in the White House, but they did. They hired teachers and had other kids come in. And but yes, and I think Amy Carter's experiences and the way that she was just paid so much attention and so little privacy and respect really did a lot to create the atmosphere that, you know, the Obamas and some subsequent presidents have done to shield their children
right.
from the press.
Well, and even with all of that, I mean, the Bush twins got a lot of press when they were in college
yes.
or partying or whatever. Chelsea Clinton, people would make fun of her when she was a teenager
I know.
For being a gawky teenager, like almost every
Everybody
teenager
is. I know.
Now, I want to go back to Amy Carter, though, because one of the wonderful things that you've done through this book is to give kids activities that
yes.
they can do to help them understand the White House or relate to it a little bit. And you included a recipe, but you planned to include a different recipe. You planned to include Amy Carter's peanut butter cookies.
Why didn't you?
Well, that's right. That is a funny story, Charity. When I wrote the proposal to the publisher, I said, oh, well, I knew all about Amy Carter and the Carter family's connection to peanut farming and their love of peanuts. They used peanuts a lot in different recipes, even when they served, you know, official guests at the White House. And so I had this recipe that was supposed to be Amy Carter's peanut butter cookie recipe. And I believed, I mean, it was an accurate recipe. It was in a White House chef cookbook. So I put that in my proposal. And towards the end of the writing process, I have to test out all the activities in the book to make sure they work. And I have
you
to
made
test
your
them.
Own model.
So
the
I
White
made
House
yes, you... I made my own model. I even had a child come and then follow my directions and test it. So I had to do that for the activities too. But anyway, I made the Amy Carter peanut butter cookies. And I just have to say, I mean, poor Amy Carter, she went through a lot while she was living in the White House. Anyway, I really hate to just sort of add to the
She's probably okay with it now.
But I made her cookies and they weren't very good. They were just, I mean, they were dry and you had to cook them longer than most cookies and higher oven temperature. And I had some friends taste them and they kept thinking that I had done something wrong. And my husband, who cooks dinner every night, I mean, of course, he thought that I was the problem. And so I finally, you know, I checked out. I did what any good nonfiction writer does. I kept doing my research and I looked at original newspaper articles that were published at the time when they republished her recipe, and it was all very similar. I mean, things might vary by 1 or 2 minutes or something. So finally, a friend suggested that I call the Carter Presidential Library. And after explaining the situation, I got somebody on the phone who apparently was quite a cook and had cooked many of the Carter family recipes. And I explained and asked that, you know, maybe I didn't have the right, copy of the recipe and that maybe I was, you know, had to do something differently. And her response was something along the lines of, you didn't do anything wrong. And I knew right then that I could not include a copy of these, you know, a recipe of these dry cookies in the cookbook. So then at the last minute, I had to scramble and find another recipe. You know, they were very gracious at the Carter Library and offered. They sent me other recipes that the family had used. And Amy Carter had even put in, you know, a junior league cookbook or something. But I wanted a cookie recipe. And more importantly, I wanted a delicious cookie recipe because I only got, well, I actually had two recipes in this book. But, you know, if there are only one or two recipes, and it's a book for young readers, it needs to be good.
Right. If you're going to spend that long making cookies, they should taste good.
Right.
So what did you wind up with?
Well, I ended up using Chelsea Clinton's chocolate chip cookie recipe. And it was a different White House chef at that time who had been in the White House, you know, when she was there. And he explained that she liked to make these cookies with friends after school and that he would send up the recipe on a little card or a piece of paper and the ingredients, and the butler would carry it upstairs and she would make them with her friends. And it's really an adaptation that the chef made from the Fannie Farmer cookbook. But he eliminated the nuts, which I thought, okay, that's good, because that was something I worried about with the peanut butter cookie recipe anyway, with, you know, nut sensitivities and allergies. And he doubled the chocolate. So I thought, and you grease the cookie sheets with butter. So I thought, what's not to like about this recipe? Double the chocolate is always a good idea in my book. In fact, I do it a lot when I cook anyway. So,
and you brought some with you.
I did bring some with me.
Oh, wonderful.
So, well, you'll have to let me know.
Yeah, we are out of time, but I will end the hour with a bite of one of Chelsea Clinton's chocolate chip cookies. Mm, crispy. They are delicious. Catherine, thank you so much.
Sure. Thank you very much.
Catherine House is the author of The White House for Kids, a history of a home, office, and national symbol. She lives in Iowa City. And the exhibit we heard about earlier at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum opens to the public on Saturday. It will be open through the summer for all of your road trip season and close on October 26th. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Sarah Bowden, Emily Woodbury, and our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow, it's Horticulture Day. This is Talk of Iowa.